Plato, Part 4, the 11th talk in a series titled The Bible and the History of Ideas, was presented by Jack Crabtree on January 23, 2013, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The handout mentioned in this talk is handout number 4 in this series.
We talked last week about his theory of forms. His theory of forms is an attempt to explain what we mean by calling something the same as something else, particularly when we're not dealing with one and the same actual entity, one and the same actual being, but you have two different beings, but we say they are the same somehow. They have a qualitative similarity, likeness to each other. And his theory of forms is an attempt to account for that. And his very simple answer is there is a form, sometimes called an idea, sometimes called an arche. He has different words that he might use for it in different dialogues. But what in the Middle Ages came to be known as a universal, that each individual thing participates in if they are like each other. So all dogs participate in dogness, and all trees participate in treeness, and all tables participate in tableness, and so on and so forth. So the reason tables are similar to each other and the same as each other is because there is numerically one and the same existing thing that they are all connected to. That in a nutshell is his theory of forms. And the what I will call the simplistic version of Plato's theory of forms is that those universals or those forms actually exist somewhere in some parallel world alongside the material world. So some world apart from this, there actually is an entity called the form of tableness or dogness or treeness or whatever. That's the simplistic version. Now, that's actually a version that Aristotle critiques Plato for. So who am I to call into question Aristotle's interpretation of Plato? But I do have to wonder, was it a straw man that Aristotle was criticizing? It wouldn't be the first disciple who doesn't understand his teacher, misconstrues it, and criticizes it. It wouldn't be the first time in history. In any case, I think there's an alternative way of looking at what Plato was saying, namely that, in fact, something like tableness exists, but you can believe that tableness really exists without believing that there is an entity called tableness. I don't think you're required to believe that in order to believe the fundamental and basic insight of Plato, and that is that tableness really was a real existing thing. And for a Christian, that gets easy, because for a Christian, tableness can exist in the mind of God, the Creator, without it actually being an entity somewhere in the same reality that we exist in, or even in some parallel reality. As long as it's a very real concept in the mind of God, then it has reality and it has existence, but it doesn't have particular, it is never instantiated in an actual entity anywhere. So how to interpret Plato is problematic, because all we have are the dialogues, and through the dialogues it's hard to be technically accurate about what his view actually is, because he's usually speaking in metaphors and kind of poetic language and myth and that kind of thing. So in that regard, I promised you to go back to the allegory of the cave. In his dialogue, The Republic, he has an allegory that he tells. And the allegory goes something like this. There's a man who is in chains, in a cave, deep in a cave, and he's put in chains so that he can't turn around and he can only face the backside of the cave. On behind the man is a fire casting light on the back of the cave. And in front of the fire, behind the man, but in front of the fire, are people with little cardboard cutouts of things in the world. I don't think they had cardboard, so I don't know what, I can't remember what he called them, but cardboard cutouts of trees and cows and horses and antelope and whatever else there was, moving back and forth in front of the fire so that it cast shadows on the back of the wall. And so all the man can see is the back of the wall with these shadows of cardboard cutouts of objects in the world. Well, eventually, someone comes along and loosens his chains so that he can now turn around, and instead of seeing merely shadows of these cardboard cutouts, now he can actually see the cardboard cutouts themselves. So instead of an inexact semblance of the cardboard cutout, he can now see the cardboard cutout. Then someone leads him out into the out of the cave into the light of day, and once his eyes get used to the sun, now he looks around and he actually sees the things, the objects, the animals of which he had seen merely cardboard cutouts before. The allegory is intended to talk about the journey of the philosopher and what real wisdom, what real knowledge, what real understanding consists of. What he's saying is we in this world, we human beings in this world, when we look at tables and chairs and dogs and cats and so on, we are seeing shadows on the back of the cave wall, merely shadows of something else. Ultimately, what the philosopher needs to do is get to the point where he sees the actual animals and things in the world. Those are like the forms. Those are Plato's forms. And Plato's forms can ultimately only be seen in the light of the sun. The sun is what illuminates the forms. So ultimately, the source of all knowledge is the sun, which represents for Plato the ultimate being, the ultimate reality, basically the closest thing he has to God. He calls it the one, the good, the beautiful, different names for it. But that God-like being, existing thing, is for him the source of all knowledge. It's in the light of the one that the forms exist eternally. And everything in this world is but a shadow of a copy of the real. So that's basically his allegorical, mythical rendition of his theory of forms. Questions on the theory of forms? Okay, moving on then. There are other distinctive doctrines that some of Plato's other distinctive doctrines then make their way into his theory of forms. So, for example, I'm on 7a on page 3. The forms exist in a hierarchical order of one containing many and many existing in one. And this becomes an architectonic structure. This one can be split into many, and each of those many is split into many, and each of those many is split into more many. And you just go down level after level, like an outline, you know, dividing each thing into several instances or parts, until you finally get to what we would call the atomic forms. Those are the forms that can be divided no further. They are not divided into many. Those are just the forms that are on the boundary between the intelligible world. And by intelligible world, I mean reality as it can be grasped only by the mind. It could never be seen with the senses or observed with the senses. It's intangible. It's invisible. It's not concrete. The mind can rationally know of it, but that's all. That's the intelligible world. Well, on the boundary of the intelligible world and the sensible world are these atomic forms. And it's these atomic forms that everything in the world participates in. So dogness and the dogs participate in that. Catness and the cats participate in that form. And the trees all participate in treeness. But each of those forms is subsumed under higher, more general forms than that until you finally get to the one, which is the source of and that which contains all the forms, all of reality, everything that's real.
Can you just give an example, working up, just pick something and work it up, the smallest to the bigger.
I can't because in our sources, in the dialogues, Plato never does that. In fact, if you try to work it out in one dialogue, you think you got the picture, then you go to another dialogue and it's a different story. And for example, is there a form for Socrates? Is there an atomic form of Socrates-ness? In one dialogue, you'd think that that's what he's saying. In another dialogue, it doesn't seem to work. He can't be saying that. So do you and I both participate in the atomic form of humanness? Or do I participate in the atomic form of Jackness and you participate in the atomic form of Kathiness? Don't know, not sure. So I can't give that account because I just the stuff we have to work with is not clear about how to do that. Maybe now I did mention last week in passing there's a philosopher that's going to come along later in about 300s AD. So 600, 700 years later, but he's going to introduce a significant revival of Platonism into the history of ideas. His name is Plotinus, confusingly enough. His name is Plotinus, and he is considered the father of what they call Neoplatonism. And in Neoplatonism, he really emphasizes this point that I just made. And if I had read all of him and understood all of him, maybe he'd give an account of that, but I'm not familiar with that. But I mean, just to give you the kind of thing that I think he's thinking of, think of what biology does. And Naomi mentioned it a couple weeks ago, and I can't rehearse it, but what, kingdom, phylum, that kind of hierarchical structure.
Does that go for virtue and emotion, all those, I mean, everything?
Well, again, yeah, virtue, yes, certainly. Emotion, I doubt it. I think emotion would probably be considered an attribute of a thing because the forms only involve what, and this is actually going more to Aristotle than it is Plato, but I'm sure that they are of one mind on this. The forms have to deal with what they would call the essence of a thing. And the essence of a thing is that which makes that thing rather than another thing. But everything has attributes as well. So Socrates is white, but if you turned him from white to black, he would still be Socrates because he would consider your color to be an attribute, not an essence. That's not the essence of who you are. That's merely an attribute. Socrates is notoriously ugly. He says so. But if you made him not ugly but handsome, that would be an attribute, not a part of the essence of his form. So I think most emotions would be put in the category of passing, temporary, changeable attributes.
Yeah, I'm just wondering. I mean, so Socrates is white.
Uh-huh.
He becomes black. Does whiteness need to have a form, and does blackness need to have a... That seems like the logical conclusion. If you take form theory all the way through, then an attribute is kind of a thing in itself, and therefore an attribute must have a form. Black must have blackness, white must have whiteness.
I'm a little foggy in my recollection. There's a dialogue where he deals with that quite explicitly, and I'm just trying to remember it. I think the answer is no, it wouldn't have a form.
Okay.
Because he talks about these attributes coming in, what's he call them? Pardon?
Like contraries?
Yeah, contraries, contrary pairs. And so, I mean, so what, like hot and cold, they can't coexist. So when hot comes in, it chases cold out. And when cold comes in, it chases hot out. Mm-hmm. So he talks about these contrary pairs of, and I don't remember exactly the word he uses, but I don't think the way to read him is that they have their own form. They're a different kind of reality.
Okay. Do you agree that that might be, I mean, if you take the form's assumption, that might you have
be a
to have
a, might be a problem?
Well, that you have to follow the logic, you have to have a form for everything. Black would need blackness, I think.
Well, except that on his own terms, I don't think it's necessarily that it would have to be, because I think what he's... what question is he answering? I think the question he's answering is, how do you explain that different, what he would call, what Aristotle will call substances, mm-hmm. and we'll have to talk about that as leave that alone. We'll talk about that with Aristotle. That different individual things, individual existing things, can be the same. But whiteness is not an individual existing thing. You never see a thing of whiteness. Mm-hmm. You see individual particular beings that are white, mm-hmm. but you never see whiteness itself in our experience. So I think on his own terms, he doesn't need a form to explain that.
Okay.
That's just the reality is that entities have different attributes, and so he explains their attributes by explaining that they, I don't remember the word he uses, but the attributes characterize them in some way.
With your Christian spin on it, would God need to make whiteness before he makes white things?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, so, for me, okay. It would be more likely for me that I would have to have a form of whiteness, that is, a concept of whiteness in the mind of God, than it would for Plato, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so the fact that God, I mean, he has some kind of ultimate being that's making everything, but he doesn't need whiteness to be the intermediate state before you get things that are white.
I'm sorry, one more time? Yeah.
Plato has some kind of God in his mind, but he does not, this God in Plato's mind does not need to make whiteness before he makes things that are white.
Yeah,
because of the assumptions that you gave.
Yeah, because let's back up for a second. For Plato, God is not really making the world. Not in the Christian sense of a creator creating the world. But I'd have to read the Timaeus to be able to. I'm shaky on this as well. So this is more Plotinus than it is Plato. I can't promise that this reflects Plato. But for Neoplatonism, Plotinus, the world is not made. It just kind of spills out of God's being. It's not a conscious, purposive crafting of the world. It really already implicitly exists in the being of God. And so what we call the world is just the spillage of God's profound, abundant being leaking out and dripping out and becoming barely real.
I might be wrong, but I think one of the problems that's tripping us up is the materialist problem again, in the sense that what's going to be a form for Plato isn't necessarily going to be everything that we see existing on our plane of reality. It's concerned with with the things that seem to be eternal and don't go out of existence,
right,
and their correspondence to things that are in existence. So, like, I mean, the question would be like, well, is there, like, what color is Katniss? And Plato would be like, that's not a question. What are we talking about?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, things like color are, for Plato, would be an attribute because it's not something that necessarily affects the ultimate form and is sort of, in fact, just an aberration of the fact that we're one of these less than real things participating in the other thing.
And that's a good point.
So, yeah. I think that's more of how they would think about it. It's not like, well, it exists out in the world, we see it, therefore it must have a thing. It's more of a, well, but is it, like, eternally necessary?
Right.
And
right.
I think Plato's response for colorness and hotness and coldness would be, no, that's not really eternal. Those things are just changing.
That's a good point. I actually hadn't thought of it in those terms, but I think that might be. The question was, what makes it eternally necessary? And you said if a species goes extinct, you know, for I don't think Plato is going to be really thinking in terms of species going out of existence, because I don't think their scientific knowledge at that point really had a category for that. But think of an artifact going out of existence. You know, what if you took a sledgehammer and a blowtorch to all the tables in the world? You could get rid of every table and turn them to a pile of dust and ashes, but a craftsman could come along and make another one. Well, how would he do that? Because tableness has not gone out of existence. And that, I think that's what he's talking about. That's the thing that's eternal, are those things that even if you were to take every particular instantiation of that thing in all of reality and destroy it, it's still possible another could come into existence. And why could another one come into existence? Because the idea itself still lives on. It's still very real and has existence to it. Okay. The one and the eternal forms are very, very real. They're eternal. They're not going away. They're not going out of existence. And remember, I talked last time about what makes something real. Something is real if it is not vulnerable to going away, going out of existence. We, this table, are very vulnerable to going out of existence, so they're not real or not very real. It only has like borrowed reality. Its being is very vulnerable, so it's not very real. So yeah, whenever you're dealing with Plato, you got to get that locked in first. That's what we're talking about, because if you use our concept of real, you're going to be hopelessly confused reading Plato. So the forms and the one are real, the rest of us are not. Now, this is going to become, I'm jumping ahead, but this is going to become instrumental in Augustine's concept of evil. Wait, we're several centuries later now, but Augustine came into Christianity through Platonism. I mean, he says so. That's how he tells his story. He read Plato, and that's what convinced him that the Manichaeanism that he had been an adherent of was false, could not be right. So he becomes a Platonist instead of a Manichaean, and then from his Platonism is influenced by St. Ambrose and ultimately becomes a Christian. But as you look at Plato's writings, Augustine's writings, early Augustine is as much Platonist as he is Christian. Arguably, I think Augustine scholars would tell you that the later Augustine is becoming more Christian than he is Platonist. But it takes a while. It takes a while for him to shed his Platonism. And I don't think he ever completely does. One of the places you see it is Augustine has a very, very famous doctrine that evil is not real. Okay? Well, how is he thinking about that? Does Augustine mean there ain't none? When it comes to evil, there ain't none? No, he's not saying that at all. He's a Platonist, right? So, thinking like a Platonist, to say that evil and sin is not real, or it has no being, it is non-being rather than being, or the way he typically puts it is, evil is the absence of good. And since it's the absence of good, it's not the presence of anything, it's simply the absence of something. And since it's the absence of something, it has no being. And then I think he makes a logical fallacy. Therefore, God can't be held accountable for evil because it isn't anything. Okay, but mostly, like apart from perhaps that last step, and when we get to Augustine, we can talk about that. But apart from that last step, if he's just thinking like a Platonist, he's not saying that evil is not there. What he's saying is it doesn't have the eternality of the being of the goodness of God, for example. It's non-real by comparison. By comparison, it does not have existence. God has existence. Evil, no evil, has existence. Well, I think on biblical terms, that's right. I mean, yeah, that's right. God is the only one who really has being in and of himself, and being a good person and only a good person, the Father of lights in whom there's not even the slightest deviation, being an only good person, then the only kind of being that has ultimate reality and necessary existence is goodness. That's true. So what is evil? It's derived. Evil is in a sense, the absence of good. Now, to use that as an answer to the problem of evil, however, is completely specious. Because my problem with evil is not that it's derived. My problem with evil is that it's there. I don't care how derivative it might be. I don't care what you do with the metaphysics of evil. The problem is, why do we have a world that where there is evil there? That's the problem.
So are you saying that evil doesn't have a form, as in a universal?
I think that's
for all the forms,
that's exactly
like darkness
what
and humanness and flowerness, but evil doesn't
have that's
a
what
form.
Augustine is saying. So it's not one of those things that is in being.
So it wouldn't be an idea in God's head? Or
that's what they'd have to be saying, yeah. It's the absence. It's when something has fallen away from that idea in God's head. And that's exactly what Plotinus said. Evil is a result of the falling away from being. Well, on that particular point, no, I think evil as we confront it and think about it, it's more helpful to think, yeah, God has an idea of evil in his head. Now, the idea of evil in his head doesn't imitate or derive from something God is. It arises in his creative imagination. It's a depiction of what he is not. So, but as an idea in his head, I have no problem thinking that that's exactly what it is. And things in this world imitate or copy or participate in that idea in his head. Okay. Okay, the other, moving on then, point C, the foundational ideas, sometimes they're called the arche, to talk about how fundamental and foundational they are. The foundational ideas can be apprehended in one of two ways. Discursively, so through reasoned discourse, step-by-step, methodical, systematic, just what we typically think of as reasoning or thought. That's what I mean by discursively. Or, and this is not Plato's term, this is my term, but intuitively. He actually uses the word through contemplation. But I think the best way to understand what that could possibly mean for him is it's a way of describing an intuitive, what seems immediate, direct, spontaneous contact with this knowledge. So it's, I think I've commented already that I think Plato is a rational mystic, and it's almost, to be a true Platonist, you're kind of quasi-religious, because the life of the philosopher is ultimately, the ultimate end of the life of a philosopher is to contemplate the forms, and through the forms to contemplate the one. But unlike the mysticism of the Middle Ages that is a kind of non-rational, yea, even irrational, anti-rational mysticism, Plato doesn't know anything of an anti-rational mysticism. His is a rational mysticism. So for him, you can prepare for a life of contemplation through discursive reasoning. Get good using your mind to discern the forms in the particular things in the world. Be a scientist. Be a keen observer and thinker about what it is that you are seeing and observing. The more you train your mind in the things of the world, the more you will equip it and prepare it to go beyond this world, take a leap beyond this world, and actually contemplate the forms in and of themselves. Exactly the opposite of the mystics in the Middle Ages. The mystics in the Middle Ages taught you to train your mind to not think, to empty your mind, to do an end run about reason, try to eliminate reasoning and thought from your mind, and by making your mind go blank of all rational functioning, then you are better prepared to have a mystical experience and a contemplation of God. So it's exactly the opposite in that regard for Plato. But that's the life of the philosopher. And the end goal that he is seeking to achieve is finally contemplation of the one and the forms. And he sees it as a ecstatic kind of experience, just this wonderful, marvelous, the marvelous clarity, rational and intellectual clarity of this experience is a kind of ecstatic experience that is worthy of a god. That's the happiness of a god would be to see the forms in the way that you could see the forms as a philosopher. And a philosopher who's achieved that, we'll get back to that. The philosopher who's achieved that leaves the cycle of reincarnation, which I'm going to talk about in a second, that Plato believes from his Pythagoreanism, leaves the cycle of reincarnation and is never to return to this poor, looking at the shadows on the back of the cave world that is so so weak and miserable by comparison to contemplating the forms themselves. So for Plato, that act of contemplation, now notice, it's knowledge, it's understanding, it's wisdom. Notice how one-dimensionally intellectual it is. I think that's important to understand with Plato. It's one-dimensionally mental. Wisdom, understanding, knowledge, granted, it's contemplation, so it's a kind of mystical intellection. But however much it's a mystical act of mind, it's an act of the mind, it's mental. That's going to eventually make its way into the Middle Ages in the form of what they call the beatific vision. I mean, it's impossible to read medieval philosophy without constantly running into the beatific vision. The beatific vision was their interpretation. There might be other passages in the Bible they would go to, but it's their interpretation of the Beatitude: blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. So seeing God, having a vision of God, is what they call the beatific vision. And how did they understand that? What did it mean to see God? Well, there are different interpretations of it that would be offered, but one of the most common ones is taken straight from Plato. To see God is to see the mind of God, and is to know all things as God knows all things. Well, what are the all things? Well, the eternal things, you mean like the forms, you know? I mean, everything that there is to know, if you could know all of God's reality the way God knows all of God's reality, from their perspective, what could be more blessed? What could be more fulfilling? What could be more satisfying to a human being than that? Well, I can think of a few things, but I'm not thinking like a Platonist. For Plato, as we will see very explicitly in his disciple Aristotle, what is it that makes a human being? His reason. One of Aristotle's definitions of a human being is a human being is a rational animal. And what he means by that is, in all other respects, we're just animals. But what is the one distinctive thing that makes us different from all the other animals and therefore describes our distinctive essence as a human being? My reason. Well, that left a huge, lasting impact on Christianity, because it turned all of Christian thought and all of Christian theology Greek word rather than Hebrew word, Jewish word. It took this faith that arose in the context of a Jewish worldview and cut it off from that and made it completely and totally fashioned after the image of Plato the philosopher. in the sense that it made it so one-dimensionally mental, one-dimensionally rational. Because from a biblical perspective, what is the ultimate fulfillment of a human being? Knowledge? It includes knowledge, certainly. But knowledge is more important now than it will be in the age to come. I mean, remember Paul's explicit statement, now we know in part, then we will know in full. As for knowledge, it is passing away. What is it that remains? Faith, hope, and love. Ultimate reality, for ultimate fulfillment for us, is much more multidimensional. The Bible calls it life, not knowledge. So what we have in store for us is life in the kingdom of God, life, ionic life, life that pertains to the age to come. That's what we have in store for us. That's the reward. That's the promise. And I would argue that's our eudaimonia, our fulfillment, the satisfaction of our being and our existence is to have that life. Well, what is that life? Well, the New Testament authors can't describe it really, except to say that it's like this existence, only death removed, evil removed, futility removed, and multiply it by a factor of 100,000, million, whatever, more spectacular and rewarding than this one. I mean, the closest thing you get to that is in 1 Corinthians 15, where he's talking specifically about our body, that we are going to receive a new body. Now we have what he calls an earthly body, but then we will receive a spiritual body, which is a weird concept, a spiritual body, but a spiritual body. And I think what he means by that is simply not this body, but something more and better and superior to this one. And at one point he likens the spiritual body is to the earthly body as the flower is to the seed, that there's going to be continuity. My spiritual body will be me. It's going to arise out of who I am now. It's going to come from my identity now. I'm going to maintain my identity, just like a flower maintains the identity of the seed that gave rise to it. But look how much more spectacularly beautiful and glorious and interesting the flower is than the dry, gnarly little seed that it came from. That's the kind of comparison he gives. Now, if that's true of our bodies, it seems to me that that's going to be equally true of the created order itself. The new earth will be more glorious than this earth as the flower is to the seed. The new heavens will be as much more glorious than the heavens that now exist, and they're pretty spectacular, as the flower is to the seed. That's right. Right. So the point where I was headed was, we're going to have an existence in that much more glorious reality, and that much more glorious reality is not going to be more boring than now. It's going to be less boring than now. If we have adventure now, we'll have adventure then, I would think. If there are obstacles to overcome now, there will be obstacles to overcome then. I mean, surely it will not, the images that we have that make our eternal existence so one-dimensional that you get bored just even contemplating that, that can't be right. I mean, that's not at all what the New Testament is portraying. Rather, it's depicting life, but more abundant. A life that is better than now, and with all the things that make this life bittersweet taken away from it. The death, the evil, the futility, the injustice, the suffering, the sorrow, the grief, all the stuff that makes this life a mixed experience. Reward, joy, and delight mixed together with bitterness. The bitterness is removed, and the delight is amplified. That seems to be the New Testament picture.
Would, in a literary way, allegorical way, possibly at least metaphorical way, a decent attempt at this, at starting this, be something like Lewis's The Great Divorce?
Yeah.
In life, things are solid, and mm-hmm. the earthly experience is insubstantial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
Like a shadow.
Notice how Platonic
that is. Yeah, that sounded Platonic, didn't it?
But as a, I mean, if you don't take the Platonism literally in The Great Divorce, as a way of kind of, yeah, as a metaphor for how much better it will be, I think that's a very good attempt. Very, very interesting attempt. Moving on before we run out of time. Other doctrines and things of note in Plato with respect to knowledge. For him, knowledge is not sense perception, which is mere appearance or seeming for him. It's judgment. You know, I'm looking at the shadow on the wall. When you look at a shadow on the wall, you don't know what it is. You have to make a judgment about what it is. I mean, that's a good example of how Plato looks at sense experience. When I look at a table, I'm looking at a mere shadow. So to really know what this is, I'm going to have to use my mind, not my eyes. I'm going to have to move from whatever vague, unclear data my eyes give me and actually make a rational judgment. So Plato puts history of ideas on the path of rationalism from here on out that lasts for centuries, not empiricism. Empiricism is going to have to be revived because Plato comes along and knocks all the empiricism of the Stoics and the, we haven't even dealt with them yet, and the Cynics and the Skeptics, knocks it aside. Now, they come later than Plato, and they come along and they have their heyday, but when Plato comes back and gets reintroduced by Christendom and comes on strong, it knocks empiricism for a flat on its back for a while. And it doesn't really return until the Enlightenment, in big time. So his sense of knowledge here is rational judgment wins out for in the history of ideas. Now the biblical view is, I've already commented on this in the context of the pre-Socratics, but the biblical view honors both empiricism and rationalism. Radical rationalism is wrong, I think, as is radical empiricism. Radical empiricism tries to say, my knowledge happens to me. Later we're going to talk, if unless the Lord returns first, we're going to talk about David Hume, who basically, or John Locke for that matter, who has the perspective that, you know, my eyes are a hole in my head, and all this data comes at me through my eyes and makes an impact on my brain, and that's knowledge. I didn't do nothing. I just had a hole in my head. I didn't do nothing. It just happened to me. The more radical the empiricism, the more passive you are as a knower. You don't do anything to gain knowledge. It just happens to you. Rationalism is the other extreme. It's all my mind coming to knowledge. And the world coming at me has very little to do with it. It's pretty irrelevant to that process. So much so that a true rationalist really kind of has the perspective that if you want to know what's real, sit down in a nice soft chair, put your feet up, grab your pipe, and think really deeply about what would the rational way for the world to be. And if you can conclude what the rational way for the world to be is, then that's the way it is. Gotta be. How could it be otherwise? But I'm looking out the window and it doesn't, shut up. The world is not that way. That your eyes are deceiving you. I know the way the world has to be, so that's the way the world is. I mean, that would be a really radical rationalist. And those impulses to move toward radical empiricism or radical rationalism are going to kind of fight over the course of the centuries. But mostly rationalism is winning. The fight doesn't really begin until the Enlightenment, and then you have a real collision between those two. What's the biblical perspective? Well, it's kind of the common sense median between those two. Of course, you don't know the way the world actually is unless you go look. Open your cotton picking eyes and take a look and see what's there. But when you open your eyes and see what's there, every perception involves a mind making a judgment. You are never too far removed from your mind having to draw a conclusion. that's a table that I see. Now, for most things, it happens so automatically and naturally and intuitively and effortlessly that you can certainly get the impression that, well, I didn't make a judgment. I just saw that it was a table. Well, there was a time in your life when you didn't open your eyes and just see that it was a table, like before you knew what a table was. And before you had ever seen a table, it's something you learned. And you learned over time because your mind had to instruct itself. And we'll talk more about this later in the history of philosophy. But ultimately, I fundamentally agree with someone like Kant, who's coming later, a German Enlightenment philosopher, that the world that we experience is ultimately a construct. We have to construct the world. It doesn't just come to us. God gave us the equipment to construct the picture of the world that we then know and navigate and deal with and so on. But we'll talk more about that later. But that's the rational aspect. You don't construct without making judgments about, you can't make a picture without deciding how to make the picture, and you can't decide how to make the picture unless you have a mind capable of making the appropriate kind of judgments to decide how to put this all together and how to understand this. So, I mean, my favorite epistemologist is Thomas Reed, who is going to say, God created the mind to know the language of reality. In effect, this is what he says. The world speaks to us. The texture of the table, I have a sensation in my fingertips. What's the relationship between that sensation in my fingertips and the idea of smooth as in a smooth surface? It's not like the sensation is smooth. It means smooth. The table's talking to me. Through my fingertips, the table is telling me what it is, what its texture is. The fragrance of the rose doesn't look like a rose, right? But I know that my nose is getting information when it has that fragrance. The rose is saying, "I'm here, I'm here, I'm here. I exist," and my mind is equipped to learn what that fragrance means. I learn the language of nature. So I'm not taking a camera shot of reality through my senses. My senses are very, very different devices used to interpret the language of nature so that I can make contact with nature and know nature as it speaks to me about itself. But all that involves the mind making judgments, rational judgments. In that respect, the rationalists are right. But my mind is not creating reality. It's discovering a reality that really is out there, and that's where the empiricists are right. Yeah.
So I don't know if this is a Duncan, but I'm trying to understand the empiricist. They think it just happens. It's almost like the mind isn't biased or doesn't think. It doesn't have any. I'm not sure right. How they can come to that. I'm not sure how a reasonable person can come to that conclusion. So
Did I say they were reasonable?
I'm not sure I'm grasping what they're thinking or whether their worldview is there.
Well, here's the best way.
It seems to totally divorce itself from.
Well, here's the best way to understand, to make that plausible. They are imagining all of knowledge like visual memory. So I turn and I look at the board, and then I turn away, and I actually have a visual memory of what it is I just saw. They try to liken all knowledge as analogous to visual memory. I have an experience of the world, and then in the archives of my mind, in the memory of my mind, is a photocopy of what it is I experienced in the world. And whenever I claim to know something, I file through the file cabinets of my mind searching for that experience and go, oh, that was it. That's the only way I can make it plausible. That's literally how That's literally how David Hume is thinking about it.
But it seems like the mind, in order for that to work, would have to be constructed in some way to be able to receive that information, like the rationalists say.
Well,
so
exactly. And
it seems to lack coherence.
Yeah, it does. I mean, that's why I don't give it any credence.
Or should I say it lacks sophistication?
It really does. It really does. And that's what astonishes me about, there are a lot of people today who would still champion David Hume. And it's almost inexplicable because it is so unsophisticated. It is incredibly unsophisticated. But he's anti-Christian, anti-religious, anti-metaphysics. If you buy into Hume, you don't have to be in any way a theist or a metaphysician. And because people have that agenda, David Hume becomes the patron saint of their perspective. I think that's the only reason he can be interesting or attractive, because he's not, in my mind, a very good philosopher at all. He's a guy with an agenda,
Is it anti-theist because if there was a construction to receive it that would suggest a God? Is that what makes it? If my mind was constructed to perceive the information, that would suggest that God created it? Is that why it's anti-theist?
Well, basically, if God existed, you'd have an experience of him. And people haven't had an experience of him, so where's this? He has to explain where this idea of God comes from, and he gives an account for it, basically arguing that it's kind of a mind confusing itself, patching together experiences that from different experiences, fragments of experience, and coming up with a God. He's basically a big version of a human being. So we need to go here shortly, but
so epistemologically, I think I agree that you need a median between rationalism and empiricism. And I think that's the rational perspective, but when you say the biblical view is somewhere between rationalism and empiricism, I mean, the Bible isn't a philosophy textbook. And so I'm wondering how...
Okay, good question.
How you are constructing out of the Bible.
Yeah,
the biblical view is this place in between rationalism and empiricism.
Right. There's no book of the Bible that is the Bible's epistemological treatise. So, you don't have it ever discussed as such. But tacitly, implicitly,
what is the epistemology of all of mankind from the beginning of time till now when they're not doing philosophy? Common sense rationality, common sense rationalism, I would call it. And so what I'm arguing is the biblical perspective doesn't do anything to challenge common sense rationalism. It assumes it, tacitly assumes it on every page. So that's what I mean by saying that's the perspective of the Bible. Not that it articulates the tenets of common sense rationalism, but it assumes it.
And it assumes some amount of empiricism.
Well, by common sense rationalism. Yeah, exactly. Okay, we have a tad bit of Plato left that we have to finish for next week, but then we'll get into Aristotle next Wednesday. Thank you.